My name is Taylor Womberg. I'm the Maritime Commercial Markets Manager at Lloyd Register, which means in the region I look after our relationships with charters, traders, banks, insurers, and a generally broader set of stakeholders than we traditionally speak to. And that's all part of our advisory business. And I'm going to give you an update on sort of our views of EU ETS and fuel EU, where we're at, and some of the pitfalls and things to consider going forward. I think we're all aware that we're in the midst of an evolving maritime emissions regulatory landscape. We are all anticipating what's going to come in the next couple of weeks from the IMO to give us a little bit more clarity, but we're also experiencing or have experienced a lot of other short-term measures from the IMO, and then the topic of today's conversation, the EU regulation. We sit and we've got a little bit of a risk that we end up with a fragmented, geographically fragmented regulatory landscape. But one thing that's common amongst all the different approaches to measuring emissions and ranking and trying to encourage us down this road of decarbonization is that for a lot of emissions regulations, it doesn't just require the actions of a ship owner, it doesn't just require the actions of a charter, but usually in order to succeed in any one of the regulations, it requires the cooperation or the collaboration or at least discussion between two parties on how they work together because of the operational element that's so prevalent. That's particularly true with EU ETS. Our estimate is that this year for what's happened in 2024, probably the industry will require about 34 million EUAs to account for the shipping activities into and out of in the EU. If we look at how much the market rate of an EUA is, somewhere anywhere from sort of 58 to 90, and it fluctuates, that's quite a significant cost to shipping that we need to try and account for. So in addition to just looking at how do we comply with this new regulation, what are the mechanics for our means of compliance, we've also had this conversation of who's going to pay. And because of the variability with the payment structure, with the EUA pricing, there's been a lot of people thinking, well, can we take advantage of this? So we've had a lot of questions from our customers on how best to set that up, how best to comply. Over time, as we've got closer to the deadline to submit their final reports, I think we've become more settled with our position on EU ETS. But those ambitious compliance strategies around trading EUAs and making some profit out of that variability have kind of subsided. There's still some that are doing it, but subsided to a more practical compliance approach. And what do we need to do to get over the line so that we can comply? And how do we manage our risk and our exposure to EUAs? And how do we work with the different parties? We've seen BIMCO try to support with this with the development of various clauses to support the industry, but equally, we've seen the industry then, in many cases, almost all cases now, we're seeing the industry come up with their own variations of the BIMCO clause, and they're being negotiated between the various interested parties. Once, now we're kind of at the compliance deadline, we've had 1 year of ETS, and I think most of the customers we're speaking to are relatively comfortable around EU ETS and what it means for them, at least in terms of how they're going to comply, maybe not comfortable with the fact that they still have to pay. And I think that sets a sort of maybe false sense of security when we go to look at fuel EU. And there's many, many similarities. And I think when we are presented and when we're presenting to the industry, we tend to talk about them in the same vein. But there's a lot of subtle differences between the two regulations. And it's those differences that I think offer up potential pitfalls for organizations or parties that do a copy-paste approach to how they're dealing with EU ETS and when they look at how they're going to deal with fuel EU maritime. I've picked out four. I can tell you that there is a long list of very subtle and obscure differences between the two. And if that applies to your trade and your place in the industry, it's something that you can potentially fall foul of. So we know that we're not looking at tank to wake, we're looking at well to wake. So the need to look at how fuels are sourced and procured so that you get the right certification and that you're selecting fuels that have a lower life cycle emission as opposed to just the emissions when they're burnt in the vessel's engine. We also see that voyages that would be in scope for ETS sometimes aren't in scope for fuel EU. So we've got certain countries who haven't yet ratified, and we've also got different treatment of outermost regions. So if that applies to you, you might find that you've got voyages in scope for ETS but out of scope for fuel EU. We also see a difference in how we're accounting for fuels when we're going into and out of the EU. So it's beneficial if you're using lower emissions fuels. Yet, if you're not aware of that, you won't be able to take advantage, or you might choose a different strategy that means you're still paying for a fuel but not getting the full credit for it. And then, quite simply, we've got different compliance deadlines as well, which makes managing that more difficult as well. With all of these differences, Fuelly also introduces a bunch of sort of flexible compliance regimes and an element of optionality in how you do that. So through pooling, borrowing, and banking. And with all of this complexity and optionality, there's a lot of opportunity if you understand the regulation and if you've taken the time to do that and you're able to negotiate contracts that are in your favor when you're talking about time charter party agreements and other things like that. Once again, BIMCO have done a commendable job at trying to look at what that might look like and provide a framework. But again, I'm a strong believer that that will just be a framework. It will come down to those that understand their position and understand the regulation, understand the exposure, and understand and are very clear about what their strategy for compliance is. And they'll be in a better position to negotiate those contractual agreements and those commercial agreements moving forwards. Just a quick look at what BIMCO sets out, and I'll go into a little bit of a case study to highlight sort of where some of the pitfalls might be or why it might be so important for you to have a really strong understanding of the regulation and then what it means for you. But because ultimately, whilst the regulation sets out what needs to be done, it doesn't tell you how to do it. So BIMCO have tried, but as I said, this will become a commercial negotiation. So there's an obligation on the ship owner that they must share what the compliance balance of the vessel is before handing it over to the charterer. So that seems to make sense. You then know where you're starting from and you can proceed from there. There's also then, if the charterer provides a lower emission fuel and that generates a surplus, there's a facility within the clause for the ship owner to pay for the surplus to the charterer. But it's still up to commercial negotiation as to what that value will be and how that works exactly. And I know there's cases where there are existing clauses where two parties have agreed and it's not quite working that way. On the flip side, the charterer has the opportunity to use lower emission fuels. They then sort of BIMCO suggests that if you provide lower emission fuels, you have some say over the surpluses that are generated. So it also provides the opportunity for you to choose whether they are pooled, banked, etc., etc. And then, of course, if you choose not to use lower emission fuels, BIMCO has the facility that you would then pay a penalty to the ship owner. And that all seems relatively straightforward. And certainly, if we look at a simple, small time charter over a couple of months, charter opts to use a traditional fuel, it's above the requirements. As a result, you have a negative surplus. And if you follow the BIMCO clause by the letter, then they would pay the owner an agreed penalty based on the amount they're over and the amount of fuel that's used. And I think generally, whilst we might not like it, we can generally see that that's something that makes sense and subject to what you've agreed. When we add in sort of the other parts of the year and take a more complete view, and particularly in this case from an owner's perspective, if we have two charters at the start of the year that take the same approach of using traditional fuels and they pay a penalty to the owner because they've generated a negative compliance balance, the owner then finishes the year. They have a couple of months. They have a good understanding of the compliance balance, and they have taken the initiative to understand what their compliance strategy is going to be. So they can take potentially the penalties that they've been paid for the first two charter periods. They could then choose to invest or use that to fund biofuel off their own initiative, and that would then generate them a surplus, and they wouldn't have a penalty to pay to the EU. And they may also find, and this is sort of a much simplified example for a piece of work that we've done for a client of ours, they may actually find that they have a surplus of within fuel EU that they can then bank for future years without having to dip into their pockets because of the penalties that they've made, that they've gained in the first two periods of the year. Taking a slightly different approach to that, then maybe we have a charter instead of the owner taking control of the vessel in that last part of the year. again, the charter has a view of the current compliance balance for the vessel. They opt as well to use a B20 blend. And they do that off of their own accord. Because of the way the BIMCO clause is structured, they've negotiated such that they will be paid a surplus for the provision of biofuels because they've generated a surplus for the owner. So there'll be a repayment from the owner to the charter. So the charter is, in the third case, is relatively happy. They've potentially covered their cost. But the owner in this case finishes the year where they've had two periods where they've had a penalty paid to them to cover the negative surplus. But in that last period, they've paid some of that penalty back to the charter, but likely not all of it. So they finish the year where they've got a surplus, and they also then have a little bit of extra cash in the bank as a result. So I think the purpose of sharing this with you was just the importance of understanding the regulation. I think it is complex, and it's going to become more complex as we hopefully get market-based measures coming from the IMO. So you really need to understand the regulation. You also then need to understand what your exposure might be and how you as a company are going to form a strategy. And that doesn't matter whether you're a charter, an owner, or DUC holder as a third-party manager. You've got to understand what position you play and how best to negotiate your situation there. And I think those who understand the regulation, understand their position, and understand their strategy will be in a better position for those negotiations going down, and probably likely do better out of those than who haven't necessarily looked into it in as much detail. So rounding up on that theme, sort of some of the insights that I've shared come from our advisory business, and we are supporting quite a number of clients with their development of their strategy and helping them understand the regulation in preparation for Fuel EU, and actually we're doing it throughout the year as well as things are developing and come to us with questions about certain clauses or what the best strategy might be. What we're also doing through our digital products is offering solutions that help owners and or charters plan and simulate voyages before they happen and look at different fuels. And they're also able to monitor throughout a voyage or time charter period what their position is based on how the vessel's being operated and the fuel it's consumed. And then also towards the end of that, being able to, at the end of the charter party agreement or the end of the period, being able to account for all of the surpluses and deficits and where they have different obligations owed to different parties. So yeah, again, I will start to wrap up there. I think it's super important as emissions regulation becomes more complex that everyone has a very good understanding of the regulation, but not just the regulation, but how it plays in and what the specific exposure might be from your company and the way you operate your vessels. And that will then enable you a more stronger position when you come to negotiate charter party agreements and such, that you can take advantage of some of the complexities and turn that into an opportunity for yourself and your company. So yeah, thank you very much for your time. It's much appreciated, and be happy to speak to anyone towards the end. Thank you.